Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Chris from Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Good evening. My name is Chris Bruner, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank the group and Lauren for asking me out to speak tonight. I've been continuously sober since October 19, 2010. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other guys. I have a home group. It's the Philly Speaker Group. We meet in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. My sponsor would make a joke that the New Jersey Speaker Group must meet in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. But we started off in Philly, and then we just kind of, circumstance ended up over in Jersey. We had a nice weekend. A bunch of us from the group went to, down to Brigantine yesterday. Some of the group members with kids stayed on shore and went to the aquarium. Some of the rest of us, maybe about 11 or 12 of us, went on the boat and went fishing. It was a good time. I think got a little bit sunburnt, but it was a fun weekend. I had a nice time. But anyway, I'll start my story. My story started off, I guess, probably in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't there yet, but my parents both were. My mother and father were both, I don't know, from what I understand today, maybe a couple of months sober at the most. It was a speaker meeting in Bellevue, Nebraska. I've actually been to the group. It was a Foxhall group started by a guy, Dick Martin, and his wife, Peg. And they real active group. And they had a speaker meeting. And I guess at the speaker meeting, halfway through the meeting somewhere, both my folks are in there, and they're in their 20s. And halfway through the meeting, instead of listening to the speaker, their eyes lock on each other. And it was like Bill Wilson writes about in the 12 Steps, 12 Traditions book. It was boy meets girl on AA campus, love at first sight. And both of them, I actually think I may have been conceived that night. So they both leave there, and a love affair ensues. And I always tell, like, new guys that I sponsor to be careful what you wish for, because what you could end up with 39 years later is an idiot like me up here talking about my resentments. So that's what happened. And both my parents, neither one of them stayed sober. They both relapsed, went out drinking. It was ugly. I was born 9 months to the day after that speaker meeting. And then I'm born, and I'm a little kid, and I remember as a little kid. So my folks, they don't stay married. They get divorced right away. Neither one of them stay sober. My household's chaotic. My mother was, so inebriated around the clock that, and we lived in Nebraska at the time, and we're talking about 1980 in Nebraska. 1980 in Nebraska for a woman not to go and have custody of her kid was totally unheard of. And my mother was just so unfit due to her drinking at the time that my father gets custody of me. I'm living with my dad. I think probably the only reason that he was able to take care of me is because we moved in with my grandparents. So now I'm with my dad, living with my grandparents. My dad's drinking around the clock. He's hardly ever home. My grandpa drinks. And that was like the environment I grew up in. And then all the fighting and the craziness. And I remember, so my dad goes and meets my stepmother when I'm a little kid. My dad and my stepmother get married, and we move out of my grandparents' place. So we move out of my grandparents' place, and my dad and my stepmother right away, they have my little brother. And I remember I'm a little kid, and the only person in my family, everybody in my family drank. My grandfather, all of his brothers, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins, everybody in my family drank. It was what we did. And the only person that didn't drink in my family was my grandmother. And I watched from a very young age what alcoholism did to members of my family. And I remember very specifically my grandpa's brother, Don. And my grandpa had three brothers, Ron, Don, and Rex. And Don, when I was a little kid, we went to his house in Bloomfield, Nebraska, and we go to Don's house. And Don held the record for the most number of DUIs that a single person had in the state of Nebraska. I mean, today they'd have locked him up and he'd have gone to the penitentiary, but back then you didn't go to the penitentiary for DWIs. You just lost your license. You went down to the county jail and dried out. Don got DWIs on his granddaughter's tricycle. He got a DWI on a snowmobile. He got a DWI in a golf cart. He got a DWI. If you name it and it could move, Don figured out a way to get a DWI on it. But I remember going to Don's house when I was a little kid. Honestly, I mean, it's funny, but Don had like 22 DWIs. I mean, I don't even know how that's possible, right? So I remember being a little kid and going to Don's house, and Don, when we go to his house, you walk inside, and the first thing you notice inside of Don's house is that the whole house, I mean, it smells like urine, and you go inside, and you see Don, and Don died of cirrhosis of the liver. All my grandfather's brothers, except Rex, Rex died in a car accident, all died of cirrhosis of the liver. And you go in, and, like, you shake Don's hand, and the first thing you notice is that his skin feels like sandpaper, his fingernails are yellow from the jaundice, his eyes are yellow, you know, it's like you're watching him, and nobody's around because his kids all have resentments against him and hate him. They're all in rehab somewhere, and Don's just lonely and miserable, and that's it. And I remember my grandpa, his brother Rex, and Rex was at one time Rex fought in World War II, and during World War II, after World War II, he went to college and then law school on the GI Bill. So he goes to law school, and at one time he became general counsel for Blue Cross Blue Shield. And Don was a guy, Rex was a guy that just had an incredible amount of potential. He was just a smart guy, and that's what everybody says, that, you know, how smart your Uncle Rex is. Except then Rex burned it all to the ground from his drinking. And he lost his job, he lost his license to practice law, and he ended up dying alone in a welfare, in some welfare, nursing home in Louisiana. And I guess I remember when I was a little kid, because Rex was a guy that had a lot of potential, and I remember my grandmother, she'd always tell me, Chris, you got so much potential. You know, just don't drink like them. And I don't know if anybody in here has ever heard anybody say that you have a lot of potential, but I heard that over and over. We have a friend who says that if anybody's ever told you that you have a lot of potential, that means that you've never done anything with your life. So some of my earliest memories from childhood when I'm growing up is I remember my grandmother. Now, my grandmother doesn't drink, and my grandmother, she's a good Christian woman, right? She went to Mass every day. She was a registered nurse. She had a profession at a time when women really didn't have professions. And she would go work all day. She was a supervisor for a floor on a nursing home. She would come home. She would take care of her kids and then her grandkids. She was just a good woman. Probably should have been a member of Al-Anon, but she was a good woman. So my grandmother, I remember being a little kid and maybe like, I don't know, some of my earliest memories from my childhood. I remember Christmas when I was probably like 5 or 6 years old. And I remember I'm at my grandmother's house and my cousins had come up from Kansas, and my cousins are visiting from Kansas, and they're staying at my grandmother's house, and I'm spending the night because now me and my dad and my stepmother and my little brother are living, away. But I'm spending the night at my grandmother's house with the cousins, and me and my cousins are going underneath the Christmas tree, and you can, like, the whole house is decorated, right? Like, there's the nativity scene, there's the, you know, the lights out, the Christmas lights outside, and Santa Claus out front. You come inside, and you can hear Christmas music playing, and the wreaths, and all that stuff. And you can start to smell, like, you know, the food starting to cook a couple of days before. My grandmother, she was a, grew up on the farm in northeast Nebraska, an amazing cook, and you can smell the food, and the aroma of, like, you know, the cinnamon from the, you know, from the apple pies. And me and my cousins are underneath the tree, and we're shaking the presents a couple of days before Christmas, trying to figure out what's in the tree, what's in the presents, and we're guessing what's in each other's presents. And I remember the day before Christmas, like, it's still like, you know, like, there's this anticipation and this excitement, like, you can feel, and the whole family's coming on Christmas morning to descend on my grandparents' house for Christmas. And on Christmas morning, My parents show up, my dad and my stepmother and my little brother, all my aunts and uncles, my cousins, everybody shows up at my grandmother's house. My grandmother, I had 5 aunts and uncles and my dad, so we had a big family. And everybody's there at my grandmother's house. And in the morning, everybody's walking up to each other, giving each other hugs and kisses, saying, it's nice to see you, it's been too long. And there's, like, just this jovial, festive, like, feeling. And it's like everybody loves each other. And we all go inside, and I remember in the morning, the men go, most of the women and go into the kitchen, and they start cooking and preparing, like, you know, like the Christmas dinner and stuff like that. And the men go into the living room, and the men go and set up a card table. And the men start playing cards, and they start gambling, and they're playing poker. And I remember me and my cousins walking into the living room where the men are playing cards in the morning, and we're walking up to our favorite uncle around 10, 11 a.m. And we're walking up to him. He's patting us on the back, saying, you know, it's good to see you. And he's pulling a silver dollar out from behind my ear, handing it to me. And I mean, it's exciting. Like, you know, it's like a good time. But then something starts to happen. Like, you know, like the beers are coming out and the whiskey. My family drank whiskey, Canadian Club whiskey, and a lot of Coors Light beer, and the men start drinking. And in the afternoon, me and my little cousins are going back into the living room, and now we're going up to our favorite uncle, and the atmosphere is like, it just started to get like a little bit tense. Then we're going up to our favorite uncle, and now he's saying, come on, kid, just leave me alone, get away. And we go back in there a couple hours later, and now the men are getting their load on, and they're starting to lose money if they don't have. And now we walk up to our favorite uncle. I go up to my favorite uncle, Bill, and I'm going up to him expecting him to pull another silver dollar out from behind my ear. But instead, he's slamming his hand down on the table. He's yelling, God damn it, get away from me. And it's because he's losing money. It's because he's starting to get his load on, and he's angry. And we all go into the dining room to go and eat Christmas dinner. But at this point, the men are pushing each other. There's food getting thrown. It's just a bad scene. And my dad grabs me, my little brother, and my stepmother. And he takes us back to our house, and we leave. We don't eat Christmas dinner. We don't open up presents. We leave, and Christmas is ruined. Now we get back home, and my dad and my stepmother are downstairs, and I can hear dishes getting thrown, and I can hear my dad hitting my stepmother, and her screaming at him, and she's mad because he lost the rent money gambling again. And he's drunk, and they don't know how they're going to come up with the money to pay the bills. The next morning, my grandmother comes, and she picks me up. And she goes, and she tells me, Chris, she's got tears in her eyes, and she takes me to Mass with her, and we go to Mass, and it's the day after Christmas, and we're at Mass, and afterward in the car, I'm looking up at her in the car, I'm sitting in the front seat. My grandmother, back then, I got a 7-year-old, he's almost 7, he's still got a car seat, but back then it was just like, hold on, baby. But So I'm sitting up front with my grandmother. Actually, this was the craziest thing, because I remember sitting up front. She had this old Monte Carlo, and the Monte Carlo had an armrest that came down in the middle. And I used to like to sit up on the armrest. So I'd actually sit on the armrest. I'm a little kid, man. I'm sitting on the armrest in the car. I mean, I don't know. But so I'm sitting on the armrest. I'm sitting next to my grandmother. I'm looking over at her. She wants to talk to me. She looks at me, and she says, Chris, I want you to promise me something. I want you to promise me that you're never going to drink alcohol, because you see what it does to everybody in your family. You see what it does to your dad, and what it does to your aunts and your uncles and your cousins and your grandfather. And it makes them crazy, and it makes them do things that they regret the next day, and they ruin opportunities, and it destroys their life. And I look back at my grandmother, and with every fiber of my being, I look back at her, and I say, Grandma, I said, I'm never going to drink. I promise you, I'll never drink. Because I don't want to end up like them. I want to go somewhere. I want to be somebody. I want to do something with my life. And I meant it. I meant it. But I don't think that there's any such thing as alcohol prevention. I think when we find out if we're an alcoholic is when we go and we take the first drink. And I remember I'm in sixth grade, and at this point I live in Geneseo, Illinois. You guys were asking me where I was from before the meeting. I said, oh, man, no. And I figured we'd get to that later. I mean, I don't like any good alcoholic gypsy family. I mean, by the time I was in sixth grade, I'd lived in 6 different states, and usually moving in the middle of the night to avoid paying rent. So, yeah. And so I'm in sixth grade. We live in Geneseo, Illinois. Geneseo, Illinois sits between the Mississippi River and the Illinois River. And there's this old canal that in Geneseo, Illinois, is called the Hennepin Canal. And it's no longer operational, but it's a beautiful place. I mean, it's in the National Historical Registry, and just a beautiful place. And it's a place where young lovers go and take walks, and families take walks. People go to walk their dog. And I mean, if you're an AA, you probably go there in the morning to do your morning meditation. I mean, it's like one of those, just like a beautiful, serene place. And I remember me and my buddies would ride our bikes down by this canal, and I never noticed that it was a beautiful place, because I didn't see the world as a very beautiful place. I mean, I grew up in a house where there was a lot of anger and violence and drinking, and I always kind of felt like the new kid in school, because I moved around a lot when I was a kid. I always felt a little bit weird, out of place. None of the other parents wanted to let their kids come, you know, hang out at my house, because my house was the crazy house. And I remember me and my buddies in sixth grade decided that we were going to get some booze, and we were going to go take it down to this canal, and we were going to find out what it did to us. So on a Friday after school in sixth grade in the fall, it was probably 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, me and my buddies started riding down to this canal with our book bags full of, mine was full of Coors Light beer and Canadian Club whiskey. That's what my dad drank. So that was what I took from him. So that's what I was going to drink. I'll tell you what's interesting though. I continued to drink Coors Light beer and Canadian Club whiskey until I got sober. My dad today is 25 years sober, but when I was a little kid, one of the things that my dad educated me to was that Coors Light beer has no artificial additives or preservatives, and Canadian whiskey, by law, has no artificial additives or preservatives. So long as I drank Coors Light beer and Canadian whiskey, I was living healthy. We were talking about it before the meeting. My drink of choice in the morning was Coors Light beer with a little V8 juice on top, because that was my vitamins, and a little bit of pepper. And that was, I was trying to stay healthy. You guys can see, I've always been a health nut. So me and my buddies are going down to this canal, and we ride our bikes down there, and we're hanging out down at the canal, and we start a little fire, and we're sitting around the fire, and we start popping open the beers. And I don't remember if it happened after the first beer or the second beer, but what I do remember is that something started to happen that night. My perception started to change. I started to notice the sun setting. I started to notice the water and how beautiful it was, like going down the canal and the rustling and just the noise. And I just noticed that I noticed the fall leaves changing colors, and the world was just kind of a beautiful place. And I was sitting there with these kids where I'd always felt like the new kid in school, and now I'm talking to them. And I feel like I can connect with them. And then there's the prettiest girl in school, and her desk was across from mine in school. And every night I would go home and I would lay in bed awake at night, and I would think at night what I was going to say to her the next day. And in my mind, it was always so eloquent. Like, the words were just, it was poetic. And I would get to school the next day, and I would go to tell her all the poetic things that I'd thought about the night before. But it would always come out kind of like, da, 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 da. And it never came out the way that I'd imagined it the night before. And this probably didn't happen either, but in my mind, it was like everybody in the school was in the classroom was just sitting around laughing at Chris the idiot, because there he was again with his tongue tied. But for whatever reason, that night at that canal, I had a couple of beers in me and a couple of shots, and the words came out the way that I'd planned them the night before. And I started to kiss that girl. That was my first kiss. And I felt like my drinking career was off to a fantastic start. Until an hour later when I threw up all over. And I think that that's the phenomenon of craving that Dr. Silkworth writes about in The Doctor's Opinion in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. That I go and I take a drink of alcohol, and that for whatever reason, I feel that sense of ease and comfort that comes with the first drink, and I start to feel a little bit relaxed, and I start to feel a little bit a part of, and I start to kind of just get along with everybody. I hit that sweet spot, and then I overshoot the mark, and that's the phenomenon of craving. And I overshoot that mark, and before I know it, I'm throwing up over perfectly nice people. And I continued that pattern of behavior until I was 30 years old. So I leave that night, and, and what I remembered from that night was not throwing up all over that girl. What I remembered was kissing her in that magical moment. And I wanted to try to reconnect, and I wanted to try to relive that as every opportunity that I had. And through high school, I started in junior high, started living for the weekends, and I wanted to, I was a weekend warrior, and I was always the kid that during the week I was making the plans for the weekend. Where are we going to get our booze? And I did the same thing through high school, and in high school I started drinking more, and sometimes it was during the week, and I'm cutting class, and I went to my first treatment center when I was maybe 17 years old. I went to Hazelden in Minnesota. I went through their extended care program. I got out, and this was what I learned from rehab, that after spending 4 months in a primary care program and then an extended care program, it only took 4 or 5 beers to get me drunk instead of 12, so I didn't see it as an entirely bad thing. So I started having these stints in rehabs and stuff like that. And when I was 15 years old, there was something very profound that happened in my life. My father, who'd been probably the worst alcoholic I'd ever met in my life, goes out and he gets sober. He starts coming to AA. And on my 16th birthday, my dad celebrated 1 year sober. And my dad's sober a year now. And my dad, he's going to some meetings. But I think he just kind of treated AA as like a hangout spot. You know what I mean? Like, he'd come to some meetings, he'd hang out in the meetings. Hell, he probably even went to a couple of dances. But he didn't have a sponsor. He didn't have a home group. He wasn't going through any steps. And my dad got worse. And it was my 16th birthday, my dad got arrested for domestic assault for beating up my stepmother. He almost beat her to death. And when I was 17 years old, my dad had just celebrated 2 years sober. And my dad was a guy that he had been involved in a few things. Like, he'd been involved when he was drinking and gambling and stuff like that. He drove a new Lincoln, and he had his hair slicked back, and he had, dressed real nice and stuff like that. And I watched my dad go from a guy that, like, you know, always was clean shaven and fresh cut and looked sharp to, at 2 years sober, my dad, like, he looked bad, man. He looked rough. Like, you know, his hair was all messed up and he wasn't shaven and he smelled bad and he was wearing sweatpants. I was maybe like 6 months sober and a fellow over in South Jersey IA that Greg knows. I wore sweatpants to the Sunday morning meeting, and he looked at me afterward at the diner and said, you know, Seinfeld said that sweats are, if people who wear sweats in public have given up on life. I still haven't worn sweatpants in public since. But anyway, so I, you know, but my dad's a guy that looks like he's just totally given up on life, and my dad goes through like this just terrible depression, right? And my dad ends up in a psychiatric hospital. And my dad's like basically he's like catatonic. They're pumping him full of crap, and he's just and he gets out after I think he you know attempted suicide while he was in the hospital. Gets out after a couple of weeks and gets out, goes back home, and man, my dad's a mess. And my dad goes to a 7 a.m. AA meeting at the Easy Does It Clubhouse in Springfield, Illinois. That's where my dad lives. And my dad meets this guy Steve L from Springfield, Illinois. These guys know him, and Steve, this is 25 years ago, meets my dad. And my dad asked Steve to sponsor him that morning. And Steve sits down with my dad with the big book. Steve's a guy who believes in the big book. He takes guys through the steps as they're outlined in the big book. He starts taking my dad through the steps. He also gets my dad active in the other legacies. My dad gets a home group. My dad starts showing up and, you know, he's got commitment at his home group. And he's showing up regularly. And he's going through the steps. And I watched something happen, this transformation in my father. My dad went from, like, you know, just being, like, totally shot out. So all of a sudden, like, you know, he started to come back to life, and he starts to look like, you know, he starts wearing khakis again. He starts wearing a nice shirt, and he's clean shaven, and just like something starts to happen. And the big book talks about that. It says when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And that was what I started to see happen in my dad. I witnessed it with my own eyes right in front of me. And my dad starts to, and I remember I'm 17 years old, and my dad says, "Hey, Chris, I'd like to go out to dinner." And this is, I'm watching this transformation happen. And it's, you know, my dad's hanging out with this guy, Steve, and I'll tell you what, man, Steve was like an angel in my family's life. He's just, and still to this day, he's just, you know, he's just a tremendous person, just a great guy. And Steve's 40-some years sober, man. He sponsors all these new guys, and he's active, and helps a lot of people. And my dad asked me if he'd take me out for dinner. Me and my dad go out for dinner, and after dinner, my dad pulls the car over on the side of the road, and he makes amends to me. And I found out years later that over the course, it didn't take that long, over the course of a couple of weeks, my dad went out and made amends to all the people he'd ripped off, hurt, beat up, everything. Family members, landlords, everything. And I watched my dad in a couple of week period go from, my dad was a tough dude when I was growing up. I mean, I watched my dad go and run a guy over in the parking lot of a grocery store because the guy went and took his parking place. My dad slept with a .40 caliber pistol next to his bed with one in the chamber because he didn't know who he'd ripped off that was going to come looking for him. And I watched my dad go from that guy to becoming the sweetest, kindest, loving, most gentle guy you've ever met in your life. I mean, my dad today, he's just, we have a tremendous relationship. These guys, they know my father. They've met him, man. If you were to meet my dad today, there's absolutely no way that you would believe that he was like that before. You just wouldn't. AA changed his steps. AI, God, totally changed my dad. I watched it right in front of me. Totally changed my dad. Today, again, he's just, and we have such a special relationship today. Me and him, you know, we're both sober, and I love my dad to death. AA changed us both. But anyway, so I wasn't ready to hear that, though. My dad makes the amends to me, but I'm ripping and running and roaring, but I also have some successes along the way. I get my GED, dropped out of high school. I get my GED because I lived in Illinois at the time, and if you're 17 in Illinois and you're not in high school, the only way you can get your driver's license is if you get a GED, so I got a GED. So now I got my driver's license, I got a GED, a couple more years go by, I'm not really doing anything with my life, I'm selling pot on the side to go and pay my rent, and, you know, so I can party and do what alcoholics do. I'm an alcoholic in my early 20s. But then I find out, I notice all these kids that are, like, going to college, and nobody bothers them about, like, what they're doing with their life. Like, they just get to go to college, and then everybody kind of leaves them alone. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to go to college. So I go to college, and I think it took me 7 or 8 years to finish a 4-year program. No problem. and I go to college, but the crazy thing was, I set my life up around, like, my drinking. So I only took afternoon and evening classes. I tried not to load myself up too hard. People would ask me about it. I'd be like, yeah, I don't want too much stress. I went to college. I mean, I drank every day. I partied around the clock. I sold pot. I mean, life was good. Like, you couldn't ask for anything more. And, but along the way, I did pretty good in school. Like, I graduated. Listen, I never completed a year of high school. Dropped out of a year of high school. Never completed a year. But my sophomore year, I never went back again. Got my GED. Now I'm going to college, and I graduated from college with 3.96 GPA. I graduated summa cum laude, top of my class. And, I mean, I wasn't sober during college. By the time I was 30, I'd picked up 4 DWIs. I mean, I was drinking. I had stuff on my record, everything from bar fights and assaults to gun charges to 4 DWIs. But for whatever reason, I could do good in school. I don't know what it was. So I graduated from college, and I'm like, man, what am I going to do now? So I go and I take the LSAT because I see other people taking the LSAT or trying to go to graduate school. And I'm like, you know what, man, I can keep the party going if I just figure out another way to keep going to school. So I go and I take the LSAT. I get into law school. And I get into Rutgers. So I moved to New Jersey to go to, go to Rutgers Law School. And I just wish when I moved, you know what? I swear to you, at this point in my life now, I'd been in some trouble, but nothing that was so serious I'd gotten out of a lot of stuff still. And like, I'd had like this epiphany. I was like, you know what? I'm 27 years old. I got into law school. I don't know how it happened. Stuff like this doesn't happen to guys like me. I'm going to straighten out. I'm going to go down the straight and narrow. I'm almost out of my 20s. It's time to straighten out. And I'm just going to straighten out. I'm going to get to New Jersey. And that was my plan. And I only wish that when I was crossing the Ben Franklin Bridge into the state of New Jersey, when it says, welcome to New Jersey, that there would have been another sign underneath it that said, but Chris, you're bringing yourself with you. So I moved to New Jersey with this grand plan that I'm going to change. And it doesn't happen. I mean, I remember right before my 1L year of law school, I was at a concert with some guys. I'm at the concert in the morning, and one of the guys goes and tells me, man, I'm hungover. I used to get nasty hangovers. And one of the guys tells me, he says, listen, he said, what you can do to cure the hangover, he said, you just take a couple of Coors Lights into the shower with you in the morning, you drink a couple of beers, and you're good. And I went in the shower, drank a couple of Coors Lights, and I was good. I mean, I was ready to eat. I wasn't dry even. I mean, I thought this stuff was just magical. I was like, how come nobody told me about that sooner? But the problem was, now I'm an around-the-clock drinker. So now I'm drinking around the clock. So I'm drinking around the clock, trying to go to law school. And the funny thing was, my grades weren't bad, but I was just all over the place, man. I mean, I was like, in my first week of law school, I got nailed for a hit and run because I left the scene of an accident drunk. And I was just a mess, man. And I'm in law school, and now I'm going to law school, and I'm drinking around the clock, and I'm back up to my old ways with all the little side businesses in order to kind of fuel my lifestyle. And then I meet a girl along the way, so I do the only logical thing. I ask her to marry me. Let me tell you something. Getting engaged, women, they don't treat my alcoholism more than any of the other stuff that I tried to use to treat it. So I get engaged to this girl. Now, me and her are drinking around the clock, and it's just a bad scene. I'm in my third year of law school, second semester. I'm studying for the New Jersey State Bar. I'm about to graduate. My grades were good. My conduct was not. I mean, I was just a mess. And I'm driving to the law school. I end up in a minor car accident. I get in this minor car accident, and task force runs down on my car, and they find they'd been watching me. I'd been under surveillance, and they're watching me, and I get caught with a loaded handgun in the third row seat of a Dodge Durango. It was my car, and I had some other paraphernalia for other stuff, a few other things, and basically I get arrested, and I get taken to the Camden County Jail, and I get booked on a $50,000 cash bond for possession of an unregistered firearm, possession with intent to distribute CDS, and a couple other charges, and now I'm sitting in jail. I remember sitting in jail, and I call up my ex, and I'll tell you a sad thing about my ex is when I got sober, her family had taken her to rescue her, and they'd sent her off to a treatment center down in Florida, and I found out, it was maybe about 2 years ago, I got an email from her brother that she died as a direct result of her alcoholism, that she was never able to get sober. I'm in the Camden County Jail, and I call her up, and I ask her to go in. We have a digital safe in the bedroom, and I give her the combination, and I give her the name and number of an attorney. I ask her to call the attorney and get my bail made. And in the safe, we had the cash to pay the bail. And she does, and I get out the next morning. And when I get out the next morning, I call her up and she says, hey, I talked to the attorney. He said one thing that you have to do, go to his office. And I told her, no problem. I mean, I'm in my third year of law school, second semester. I know better than anybody that what I need to do is go to that attorney's office. So I get out of the jail, Camden County Jail. I look to my left. I look to my right. And what do I see when I look back again to my left? I see the blinking lights of Hank's Bar on the corner of 2nd and Market in Camden, New Jersey. So instead of going over to the attorney's office, I walk into Hank's Bar. I walk inside and I order a shot and a beer. And guess what happened when I went and I drank the shot and the beer that morning when I got out of jail? The same thing that happened to me when I was at that canal when I was in sixth grade. I just kind of went, oh, and I felt the sense of ease and comfort that came with the first drink. And all the fear of going to prison and everything else that was going on in my life left me temporarily. And I sat in that bar, and maybe 4 days later I came to and I walked into the attorney's office and he said, Chris, what's going on? He said, you're an absolute mess. He said, I don't know what's going on with you, but he said, if you can't clean yourself up, you're going to end up in the penitentiary. He said, there might be a chance I can keep you out, but he said, you got to clean up your act now. I looked back at him with every fiber of my being, and I said, Carl, I mean this. I'm done. This is it. I'm not drinking anymore. I'm not partying anymore. I'm not doing nothing anymore. He looks back at me, and he says, Chris, I sure hope so. And I looked at him, and I walked out of his office. And later that night, I got busted on the corner of 5th and Indiana in Philadelphia in the Badlands section for possession with intent to distribute interstate possession with intent to distribute CDS, heroin, and cocaine. I got set up by a confidential informant. I got taken to the 24th, 25th precinct. I got booked again. And now I know I'm sunk. And I'm sitting in the 24th, 25th. And I call the ex. And she gets the attorney, and eventually my bail gets made, and I get out. And when I get out, I know that I'm in a lot of trouble now, and I know I'm probably going to end up in prison. I know I'm hot with the cops. I hop in a cab, and I go back 2 blocks from where I'd just gotten busted. I walk into a bar because I knew that they would go and allow me to sign over the check that I got when I left the jail. And the check went and had all my cash on it that I'd gone into jail with. And I knew that they would take that check and that they would open up a tab for me with that check. And I walked into that bar and I ordered a shot and a beer and I started drinking again. And again, I felt that same sense of ease and comfort that came with the first drink. And I felt all the anxiety and fear leave me. And I went back home, and I'm sitting at home, and maybe 2 or 3 days later, I'm sitting on the floor. Now, at this point, I gotten a letter from that law school that said I wasn't welcome back. I got a letter from my ex. She's down in Florida now, and she's going through long-term treatment. Her parents tried to save her. And I know that my life, I'd gotten indicted by a grand jury in the state of New Jersey, and I knew that my life, as I knew it, was coming to an end. And I knew that the party was coming to an end, and I didn't know what to do because I couldn't stop drinking. And I'm laying on the ground of the place where I'm living, and I got a .22 automatic in my mouth, and I'm praying to God for the courage to be able to pull the trigger. And I can't bring myself to do it, and I lay on the ground for probably 15 minutes, and I'm sweating profusely, and I go, and finally I put the gun down, and I get on my cell phone, and I call up my dad and ask my dad for help. And my dad said, son, I know you're in a lot of trouble. You have been for a long time. My dad at this point is a couple of years sober, I don't know, probably 15. And my dad said, son, and I found out later from my dad and from his sponsor, it was one of the hardest moments of my dad's life. My dad said, son, there's nothing I can do for you. He said, all I can do is hope that you can go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, walk inside, and get honest with the people in there. He said, I've been praying for you for a long time, and I'll keep trying to do it. And he hung up the phone. And that's what I did. I remember that sinking feeling, and I felt like I was in the ocean and that the water was coming over me and that I couldn't tread water and I was drowning. And I said a prayer. I shot up a prayer, and I said, God, please help me. And I dialed 411, and I asked for Alcoholics Anonymous, and they put me through the South Jersey Intergroup of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I asked the fellow that was on the other end of the phone, I said, do you know where there's an AA meeting? And it was about 5:30 in the afternoon, and he gave me the address of 315 South 5th Street in Camden, New Jersey. And it was the Last Stop Clubhouse. And at that point, I said, all right, I'll go there. And I asked him, I said, because now this is what I knew about AA. So I spent all my money at this point on booze, drugs, lawyers, and bail. So I'd like to go to a meeting where people have cigarettes and can give me a ride home and stop by Starbucks on the way. So I'm like, are you sure you don't know where there's a meeting, maybe like in Cherry Hill or somewhere like that? So at least I can hustle the people. I have a couple of cigarettes, maybe $10, and they're like, he's like, nah, listen, man. He's like, if you want to go to a meeting, he's like, that's where the meeting is, and he hung up on me. It was crazy. I was speaking at a meeting not that long ago, and the guy that answered that phone was actually in there. And he went and told me, he said, I never told anybody that before. He said, you were the first guy. I said, I don't know why. I just felt like that was what I had to say, and that's what I did. And anyway, I ended up going to the meeting, 315 South Fifth Street. And when I start to walk up by the clubhouse, I see a fellow, his name's Eddie Z. And Eddie at the time, he's like maybe like 18 years sober. And he says, come here. And I went up to him and he said, listen, he said, you're gonna go talk to these guys inside and go inside. And I walked inside and they got me a cup of coffee and it was only halfway filled up with coffee. Cause that's what, you know, that way you weren't gonna shake it and spill it on anybody. And I sat down, those guys talked to me and they gave me a roll up cigarette. Hey, it wasn't the Marlboro Lights that I was looking for, but, you know, I took it. So now I got a roll-up cigarette, I got a little bit of coffee, and I'm talking to these fellas, and I don't know, something started to happen. I started talking to these guys, they take me back to a meeting in Kensington, I end up back at a meeting with them in Kensington at the Last Stop Clubhouse in Philly, and I ended up staying with those guys, and I ended up spending a lot of time with Eddie, and I don't know, I had maybe 5 or 6 days sober, and I wasn't sober very long, man. I'd been in and out of AA all throughout my 20s, right? And every time I get jammed up on like a DWI or something else, I mean, I always knew, like, you go to IOP, you get sentenced to IOP, then they make you go to a couple of AA meetings, you go to a couple of AA meetings, you stay long enough to get your card signed. If there's a good looking girl, you stay a couple of minutes longer, try to get her number, and then you skirt out to go drink, right? But I was like, actually, like, going to AA meetings. And one thing I'd never tried, though, all the times I'd go, I didn't think AA worked. I was like, listen, AA doesn't work. It just doesn't. Like, at least not for guys like me. But the only thing I'd never tried in AA was I never, like, really got in the center of AA. I never had a sponsor, and I never went through the steps. I never made amends. I never sponsored other people. I never did any of these things, right? So it was only, like, 5 or 6 days sober, man. And I remember, like, when I started hanging out with Eddie and these guys, I felt like a feeling of hope that I hadn't felt in years. Cause I kind of felt like, you know what? Maybe there's something here that could work for a guy like me. Cause I saw people that were just as screwed up as I was and they were staying sober. But then I was on like day 5 or 6 and a terror hit me. And the terror that hit me was that this time's not going to be any different than any other time. You're going to come here and you're going to go to the meetings for a couple of weeks. And within a couple of weeks, you're going to start to feel a little bit better. And you're going to go drink and you're going to end up back out there in that rat race. And you're going to end up all messed up. And this isn't the end of your drinking. This is just another chapter in the saga. And it scared the hell out of me. And I started praying and I'm asking God to help me. And I don't know what to do. And a kid comes down, he was 21 years old, he's from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and he had about probably 35 days sober. And somebody had taken this guy through the steps. And somebody told him that he had to go out and try to find knuckleheads like me and try to do the same thing with them. And this kid comes up to me, and he says, hey, he said, you want to take a walk with me? Now, I ended up taking a walk with this kid only because I didn't have any other idea of like what I was supposed to do. I had no idea. I thought if I didn't walk with him, everybody's quit hanging out with me. And then I'd really be a loser because then I'd be sober, scared, and by myself. And I'm walking with this kid, and I'm telling you, this is when the magic started to happen. And I think in its purest form, this is what AA is. One alcoholic sitting down sharing my experience, strength, and hope with another alcoholic for the purpose of recovery. And that's what this kid started to do. And as I start walking with him, what he starts to do is he starts telling me his story. And when I hear his story, what I hear in his story is my own. Because we drank in some of the same spots. We both drank in brewers in the Westmont section of New Jersey. Westmont, New Jersey. We both drank at brewers and we both had cop drugs on some of the same corners. And I'm talking to this kid and I start to notice something. I noticed that as he's talking to me, he felt the same way that I'd felt. And as he's talking to me, I notice he drank the same way that I drank. But the other thing that I notice while he's talking to me is I see a light in his eyes and I know that he doesn't feel that same way anymore. He doesn't feel the way that I feel. The lights are on in his eyes. Something's happened to this guy. And I look back at him and I told him, I said, listen, man. I said, I'll do anything you ask me to do. The difference between that kid and every psychiatrist, therapist, doctor, social worker, lawyer, judge, and every other well-intentioned person who told me my entire life that I drank too much. The difference between that kid and all those people was that I knew that he'd been where I'd been. He'd felt the way that I'd felt and I could look at it in his eyes and know that he didn't feel that way anymore. And I was sold. That was the hook. And I said, I'll do anything you ask me to do, man. What do we do? And he said, we're going to go inside and we're going to sit down with Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And we walked inside and we started reading through the big book and we got up to the third step prayer and we got down on our knees and we said the third step prayer. He gave me inventory instructions and I left that night and I was detoxed. And I don't know if anybody in here has ever detoxed, but I mean, I was going through it and I couldn't sleep. So instead of staying up all night thinking about myself, I stayed up all night and I started writing that inventory. And that inventory took me maybe 2 or 3 hours to write that night. I've written a couple inventories since then. I've sponsored a few guys since then. And I always ask people how long it takes them to write their inventory. And whether or not it takes them 6 months, a year, or one day, invariably it always takes about 2 or 3 hours. So I sat there and over the course of 2 or 3 hours, I wrote down every resentment, every sex conduct, all my fears, and I put it down on paper. It was the most brutally honest inventory I'd ever written. I called the kid up the next day. I put it all out there, and I put stuff on there I'd never told anybody that I thought I was going to take to the grave with me, but I put it out there. Nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty, and that kid comes over, and that night he hears my fifth step. And when he heard my fifth step, he gave me the keys to the kingdom. Because I believe what it says in our eighth and ninth step. I do all this for one reason and one reason only, so I can become of maximum service to God and the people around me. So I'm getting free going through this process for one reason, so that way I know how to take somebody else through these steps. I go in and I spend my hour alone, and when I spend my hour alone, I hit my knees and I start crying and I start begging God, the most honest sixth and seventh step I've ever done. And I start begging God to help me live another way. To help me be somebody else. I found the way that I'd lived objectionable, and I didn't want to hurt people anymore. And shortly after that, I went out and I started making amends. And I remember one of the first amends I made, it was to a woman who'd been my landlord in Collingswood, New Jersey. And I was an awful, awful, awful tenant. And the worst part was I went to law school, so I knew a little bit of the law, so I knew just enough to throw at her to scare her, to get her to leave me alone. And I just ran roughshod through this lady's life. And I remember one day I'm walking through it's 10 o'clock in the morning. I just woken up. I'm on the couch. There's a cigarette burn on the couch. I left the cigarette lit the night before. And I get up and I had cotton mouth. So I'm I gotta go to the fridge and get a beer or something. I'm walking to the fridge. I go through the dining room. Plunk, something hits me in the head. I'm like, what could that be? I get a beer. I open it up. I'm standing there thinking about the day. I walk back on. Plunk. Hit again. I look up. Holy crap. There's a whole bunch of water on top of the, coming down from above. I had no idea what it could be out. So I just ignore it. And the next day I notice it's still there. It's getting worse. And it turned out I'd gone upstairs and I'd run out of toilet paper. So I don't know, a month before that. So I just started using paper towels. And I guess the paper towels backed up the toilet. So I call up the landlord. I tell her what happened. She goes, oh, my God, are you serious? I mean, did that really happen? And I was like, listen, lady, I'm like, that's why I rent. So that way I don't have to be responsible to fix stuff like that. I'm like, are you serious? And she's like crying on the other end of the phone. She sends a guy out. There's a big, it costs $1,700 to, they have to snake the toilet. They replace the drywall of paint. And I tell her, I'm like, listen, why would I pay that? I don't owe you nothing. I'm like, that's why I rent. So that way you can deal with that type of stuff. If I wanted to deal with stuff like that, I'd buy my own house and rent it out to people. I hung up on her. And the lady went around, and I mean, this was a house where the cops got called for fights. I mean, it was always a bad scene. Beer bottles outside, whiskey bottles, and the lady, she'd stop by every once in a while, try to check up on her investment property, and I'd slam the door in her face and lock it. I don't know, maybe. So I get sober, and one of the things on the first column is my landlord's name, second column, and I was told to write 5 words or less, but I wrote down, called me a thief. And I remember this kid here in my inventory, he's like, why'd she call you a thief? And I said, hey, you won't believe it. She went around, she told people, well, the last month's rent, I decided the way to get even with her, because she would check up on me sometimes, wouldn't pay the last month's rent. So I don't pay the last month's rent, and then now she's calling around, calling my references and stuff from the, and asking them where to find me so she can trade, she said to somebody that I was a thief. And I remember this kid, and, it's just, I guess, the power of sponsors. He tells me, he looks at me, he goes, you know why she called you a thief? And I'm like, no, why? He's like, because you are one. I was like, oh, revelation. So I go to this lady's house, and I was told very early on, I waited a couple of months until I was able to save up the money. I was told, listen, if you smoke Newports, or you drink Red Bulls, or you do anything other than put a dollar in the basket, you're stealing from that lady all over again, because that's her money. That money belongs to her. It don't belong to you. You gotta save your money until you can go and pay her back. So I save up my money, and I quit smoking, and I'm not drinking Red Bulls, and you might guess I forewent the gym membership. And I'm saving up my money. I show up on this lady's doorstep, and when I show up, she recognizes me, and she goes to slam the door in my face, but I said, hold on, I said, I got your money. Now she opens up the door, and I paid her the money, and I'll tell you what happened. It was like a magic trick, and I think that this is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, was that in that moment, I started to see her, instead of that resentment, where I saw her as like this angry, mean person, I saw her for what she really was. She was just a decent, kind, honest person, that was the first home that she owned. Her and her husband moved on with their kids to a little nicer place. That was their investment for the future. And I went and I robbed from them. I took money from them. I stole their time. I stole their peace of mind. And I saw the truth in that moment, that she was a good person and I'd stolen from her. And I was able to see the truth, and I started to have a shift in my perception. See, the thing was, when I owed her money and I stolen from her, I had to build a case against her in my mind. And that was my second column. Because I had to justify stealing from somebody. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to sleep at night and I had to put a bullet in my head. But when I started to get right with her, what happened was I started to see the situation for how it actually was. And that was what started to happen in my life. And all of a sudden, this dark world started to become just a little better place. And I got really active in AA very early on. I had my first commitment at the Last Stop Clubhouse at like 30 days sober. I chaired the Friday night. At the time, it was a Friday night. It was an hour speaker meeting just like this one. It was on Friday nights. And it was back in 2010. And I chaired that meeting. And I got my first sponsee at like 30 days sober. I had no idea how to take the guy through the steps, so I just started doing what's done with me. And we opened up the book and started swapping stories. And that was a real special thing too, because I'll tell you, something happened about me and this guy. I start hanging out with him, and we're going through the steps, and I don't know if I'm doing it right. And he really didn't want me for a sponsor because I didn't have enough time, but nobody there had time, so he had to settle for me. And he was there about 2 weeks, and I get a call at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was Kenny, and he was crying on the phone. His cousin, who he'd loved and he was going to make amends to but never had an opportunity to, was shot on a drug block in North Philadelphia in a pot deal gone bad. And Kenny's crying, and I remember, man, 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was the first time I ever did this, the first time I ever felt this level of care, love, or compassion for another human being, expecting nothing in return. I went and I hopped on the bus, and I went and waited for the bus, and it took me until the sun came up to catch the bus, to hit the Patco, to hop on the L, to get back to the last stop, to show up and to see Kenny. And I saw Kenny, and I walked up to him, and he's sitting in the clubhouse, and he's sitting on the ground, and he's crying, and I walked over to him, I put my arms around him, I held him. And I wasn't a guy that did stuff like that, but that was what started to happen. Something started to change, and I started to put the welfare of another human being above my own as I sponsored this man. And something started to happen inside of me, and I started to soften up, and I just started to change a little bit. And I remember I was a little over a year sober, and I walked into the Superior Courtroom in Camden, New Jersey, and I had to get right for those things that had happened right before I got sober. And when I walked in, it looked like a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the courtroom. It was all the guys, Eddie Z from The Last Stop, whole bunch of AA guys. There were like 60 letters written on my behalf to the judge. I go up in front of the judge, I stand in front of him, he looks down at me, and he says, son, I can tell you a change. Something has happened to you. He said, you're a different person today than you were when you got these charges. He said, I can tell. And all these people are getting up telling him, Chris sponsors me, Chris is a good guy. But he looks back at me and he says, you got indicted under the Graves Act. Unfortunately, I have to send you to prison today. You have a mandatory minimum. He said, I'm going to sentence you to the least sentence possible. It was 3 years with a 1 year mandatory minimum in New Jersey State Penitentiary. And I remember walking out of that courtroom. And I smiled, and I looked back at all the guys that were in there, because I knew that when I was going to prison, I was only going as a visitor. It was a temporary thing, take responsibility for my actions, and get out and move on with my life. And I walked into that jail hand in hand with God. And I went downstairs into the Camden County Jail. I got strip searched in a holding room. I'm naked in there, and they're waiting to bring me in my orange jumpsuit. And I hit my knees, and I said the only prayer that you guys had taught me that I still say today, God, please show me how to be of service. And I get taken into the bullpen. I get taken up to 7 day lockdown. I'm in 7 day lockdown, and God goes and puts a fellow in my cell that was an alcoholic detoxing off of booze. And what I share my experience, strength, and hope with him. And I went and I talked to that guy for 4 days about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told him about all my experiences in AA, and we keep swapping stories, and he left, and I gave him a couple of phone numbers for guys that were on the outside to give him a call and to go to meetings with. And I get transferred to CRAP in Trenton, New Jersey, and I take the bus, and I end up in CRAP, and I should say, it's not like you just, like, hop on the bus. I mean, it's got bars on it, and you're kind of like, but, so I end up at Crab in Trenton, New Jersey, and I'm there, and we go out on the yard, and I'm out on the yard one day, and I'm talking to a guy, and the guy's an alcoholic, and me and him start swapping stories, and I told him what happened to me in AA, that I had this experience, and that I was, like, this screwed up guy. Well, look, man, I'm in prison, you know, but something happened, that I'm not that guy anymore, and me and him hit our knees, and we say a third step prayer in the yard of Crab. And I end up hearing the guy's fifth step, and he ends up writing these amends letters. And I got a letter from him after I'd gotten out of prison. He ended up at Northern State Prison outside of Newark. And when he wrote, one of the letters he wrote was to his daughter. And he had told his daughter that he's making amends to her in the letter, and she starts coming to visit him. And during the visits, she was able to tell him that she thought one of the reasons that he'd never been around all those years that she was growing up is that there was something wrong with her. And he was able to look back at her and say, baby, there was nothing wrong with you. It was me. And they were able to have healing in their relationship while he was behind the wall of the penitentiary. And I end up at Bayside State Prison in Leesburg, New Jersey. I'm at Bayside State Prison. And while I'm there, my cellie was a guy that was a nieta. He'd been in and out of prison his entire life, gang-affiliated alcoholic. And I start sharing my experience, strength, and hope with them. And by this point, my dad had sent me a big book, and it's a soft cover big book for inside, if we're behind the wall. And I'm in prison, and me and this guy, we start going through the steps as it's outlined in the big book. And what happens is we start taking other guys through the steps, and we start having little meetings. And there's little clusters of us, a couple of guys having meetings talking about AA and spiritual principles. And that was what I did when I was locked up. And I remember walking on the yard one night with that guy, and he looks over at me. He says, Chris, I'm as free now as I've ever been in my life. And I look back at him, and I said, I know me too. And I experienced complete and total freedom behind the wall of a penitentiary, doing the same thing that we do out here. What I said before, at the end of the day, it's one alcoholic sharing my experience, strength, and hope with another alcoholic for the purpose of recovery. And I walk out of parole I walk out of prison on my first parole eligibility. And I got paroled to a little town called Absecon, New Jersey. Man, I didn't even know what an Absecon was. I thought it was like, I had no idea where I was going. And I show up in this little town, this recovery house, and I get there. And I remember my first night there, I went to a big book meeting. My second night there, I ended up at an AA conference. And I just like jumped right in the middle of AA, and I'm at a conference. And I see one of my buddies from Neptune, Anthony H. And he tells me that his group has an AA commitment at John Brooks Recovery House in Atlantic City. He goes, Chris, you should take that commitment. Man, go in there fishing for new guys. I was like, absolutely, dude. So I go in there, and I start taking the meetings into John Brooks on Friday. And then a guy I sponsored just got out of Hendricks House in Vineland, and now we're taking the commitment into Hendricks House on Sunday nights. And now I'm just picking up sponsees, man. We started meeting down there, and that was when I met Greg. We hooked up, and it's like 6 years ago. And then I met my wife, and it was the craziest thing. So my wife, she's at a meeting, right? My wife's one of the most beautiful ladies you'll ever meet. She's an absolute angel. And if you ever saw the two of us together, I mean, I'm just so out of my league with her. And she comes up to me. I'll tell you what, everything that's good in my life is a direct result of what's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife comes up to me after a meeting, and she's a good lady. You know what I mean? Like, she's like, you know, she sponsored women. And she's like got a giving spirit and stuff like that. And she notices that, like, I'm sponsoring a bunch of guys. I mean, at the time, she had a one-year-old baby, and she's living in the spare bedroom of her grandparents, and she's like, she doesn't have a job, and she's screwed up and going through a divorce, and I'm on parole, living in a recovery house, working in a sub shop. If there were any old timers around, they'd have just been like, woo, get away from each other, catastrophe waiting to happen. But she walks up to me after a meeting, and she goes, you know, I really like, you know, like the way you do AA, like, you know, you help guys. Maybe we could go out and get some coffee. It took me like probably 10 minutes to reply to her. I was like, absolutely. And we went out and we got coffee, and her and I, we started spending a lot of time together, and we moved. I walked off parole and nothing happened. It was uneventful, and we moved to Philadelphia together. And when we moved to Philly, the place that we moved into South Philly, into a guy's house that, he tried to start a recovery house. It had failed. Him and his wife were living out in Bucks County at that point. They had this house, was basically just sitting empty. And he said, listen, man, he said, you know, if you'd move in, he said, the house is furnished. And he said, I know, you know, you're trying to do the right thing. And he said, you know, if you and Jessica, you guys get jobs or whatever. He said, you know, start paying off the mortgage. It was $1,200 a month, and, you know, pay the utilities and you guys can live there. I was like, man, that's great. So we moved in, and it was, you know, his kindness and generosity. That was how we moved into our first house. And we started our home group when we lived there, Philly Speaker Group. And We started to watch a fellowship grow up around us. You know, people in AA, all people that were in Atlantic City with us yesterday and on the boat trip and stuff like that. And we've all, over the last 5 years, you know, we've all had a chance to grow together. And at the time, and I'm just going to finish pretty quickly here. So at the time, my wife and I were living in South Philly, and she's working as a part-time bookkeeper. I'm working at a pizza joint in Center City. It's the only job I can get. I tried to apply at Uber, and they said, no way, because of your record. And I'm, like, basically unemployable. And I'm coming home every night, and I smell, like, you know, like pizza grease. And, I mean, it was, dude, it was, like, and, like, I had that smell on me from, like, being on the bottom of the totem pole washing dishes in a pizza joint. That is, like, that smell you can't get off yet. And at the time, like, everybody, hey, like, we're going to our group, like, we're going to, like, tons of meetings, we're traveling up and down the East Coast, going to speaker meetings and just, like, taking road trips and hanging out together. And I'm with Greg one night, and we're in the car, and Greg's like, dude, he's like, I can't listen. I'm working for this home improvement company, and I think you should come to work for the home improvement company. He's like, you know, he's like, I'm doing sales and stuff like that. And he's like, I think you'd be really good at it. And I'm like, dude, I don't think I could. You know, like, I'm a convicted felon. I got history. They're not going to hire me. He's like, listen, no problem. He's like, first of all, the owner's a convicted felon, so that's not going to be an issue. You'll have a little bit of credibility. And I'm like, I don't know, man. He's like, listen, you have to do it. He's like, dude, I can't take another trip with you smelling like this. So I was like, all right, man, I'll give it a shot. So I go and I apply with them, and I get hired. And I start working for this company. Now I'm working for this company, and I notice some stuff that, you know, I'm like, well, you know, it's a pretty good company, but I noticed that in the home improvement business in general that, like, you know, there's a lot of people that are a lot shady, man. Like, they take people's money. They don't really do what they're supposed to do. They don't show up when they're supposed to show up. Like, all the stuff that we learned to do in here, like, in our home groups and through the steps and with a sponsor and traditions. So I tell Greg, I'm like, listen, I think we should start up our own company. And Greg, he's like, yeah, whatever, man. Sounds like a good idea to me. And we have no money, no investors, nothing, right? And, like, I mean, you know, like, by this point, my wife, she's got a full-time job as a bookkeeper. I'm working for the home improvement company. We got a nice little place over in Jersey. Life is good. And I tell her, I'm like, listen, me and Greg are quitting our jobs, and we're going to start our home improvement company. She's like, oh, the hell you are. And I'm like, listen, we're going to do it, right? So we started up, and we used Greg's girlfriend. She had, like, this old Mercury Mariner. And, like, we go and we put up all the money we had to buy, like, a $2,500 trailer and go and rent some tools from Home Depot. And we put our shingle out, man. And we started providing, like, a good service and a good price. And we started doing for people what we said we were going to do. And, dude, like, the principals in AA worked in business, man. It was crazy because I wasn't too sure at first. I was like, man, this is a big gamble. You know what I mean? Like, And our business blew up. You know, I think we have over 100 employees now. We have a pretty big market share throughout New Jersey, Pennsylvania. We got a couple of offices, showrooms, warehouses, and we've done tremendously well, like, very successful. And it happened in that car riding with Greg when Greg was like, hey, man, I know you're a decent dude. Why don't you come to work at this home improvement company? And then bring the principles of AA into a business. And before we know it, we're, you know, doing a huge, huge volume. One of the largest roofing and siding and window contractors in the region. And it just blew up and took off. And God's been very good to us. So the one last thing that happened to me was when I was in prison, I remember on Saturdays and Sundays, there was visiting day. And the only guy that visited me in prison was a guy in AA from Philadelphia. And he'd come down to Bayside State Prison and he'd see me on the weekends. That was my only visitor. And I'd always feel kind of sad on the weekends because I felt filled up with God. Like, I knew that everything was okay in my life, but I would see all these guys going to hang out with their families, and I was getting out of the penitentiary, and I was in my early 30s, and I was like, man, I lost my shot. I lost my shot to have a family and to do that. And I ended up meeting my wife, and she had this little boy, and he's going to be 7 in a couple of weeks, and I got to become his stepfather, and I got to use that principle that we learned in the 12th step, you know, to show him what Dr. Bob said, to, you know, use words only when necessary, but we show people through our actions, and I got to become a role model for him. And I love that little boy more than anything in the world. And me and my wife, I came home about 2 years ago and she had pregnancy tests and she was pregnant. And about 16 months ago, we had a little baby girl and I shouldn't say we, she actually had it, but her, she had her, it's not it, but so she had this little baby girl, man, Isabella. And I'll tell you what, man, when she was born, I knew what unconditional love was. I love that little girl so much, man. And me and my kids are like the world to me. I mean, I love, you know, God, AA, my family, and that little boy, me and him now, we do karate together. I know it don't look like I do karate, but I do karate, man. He's like two belts ahead of me, so he loves it because he gets to like tell me like, you know, he's like, he gets to show me what to do. He's like, well, Chris, you need to do this. You need to do this. And the karate instructors, they'll tell him, they'll be like, Mr. Bob will be like, yeah, Mr. Jimmy, you're going to go and tell Mr. Chris tonight how to do X, Y, and Z. And he loves it, man. He just gets off on it. So. And my little girl, man, when I hold her, I'm just like, I just feel like the luckiest guy in the world, man. And I just feel so blessed. I have the most beautiful family. And my life is so full. Like, and now we have a beautiful house in East Cherry Hill, big pool in the backyard. Every weekend we have barbecues and we'll have 30 people from our home group over hopping in the pool and eating food and hanging out with us. And God's just given me just this incredibly full life, man. And I'm such a lucky guy because I just, and it's crazy because I haven't had, I don't, you know, I'm just a guy that came to AA, like nothing, I don't think I'm, there was nothing special about me, right? Same rain that falls on the just falls on the unjust alike. There's nothing more special. God doesn't love me or favor me more than any one of his other children, right? I was just a guy that came to AA and I gave it my all. And I asked somebody to help me and I took direction and I listened and I did what was asked of me. And I've seen my life just explode. And it's something that I feel like is available to anyone here tonight. And it was all because at 6 or 7 days sober, I asked another guy to help me and to show me how to do it. And I hope if you're sitting in here tonight and you're not feeling lit up, ask somebody else to show you how to do it. Thank you for my life.